from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Patrick Cotter and Republican Patrick Brady. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the SiriusXM studios on Chicago's West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to send us an email message, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. For the next couple of hours, we're going to be talking about a variety of issues in our first and second hour tonight. We have one Republican, one Democrat, like we did last week. We got a lot more calls in, a lot of good discussion. So we'll have people who usually see political issues from different perspectives sharing their thoughts and opinions. And we're also going to be talking about the workings of the Justice Department, because we are very pleased tonight to have two former deputy or assistant attorney generals of the United States who can sort of take us inside a federal indictment and some of the things that go on in the justice system that you probably don't read too much about in the newspapers. But first of all, I want to get their opinion on one of the big stories of this past week, which we briefly discussed last week, and that's the issue of compensation to those companies that receive massive bailouts from the federal government. And this week, the paymaster of the United States, who's decided to cut some of the salaries of people working for Bank of America, General Motors, Citigroup, GMAC, Chrysler, Chrysler Financial, and AIG, in many cases, they've cut these salaries by 90%. There's a $500,000 limit on any of these companies. And by the way, we should say this is specifically for companies that accepted federal bailout money that haven't yet paid it back. So there's been a lot of discussion in a variety of areas, and I want to get reaction, first of all, from our Democrat tonight, Pat Cotter. Pat, nice to have you with us.
Good to be here.
We got two Pats, so I may just go to Cotter and Brady.
That works.
But your reaction to this story, is it both good politics and good policy, or is it more good politics?
I think it's both. I think it's a term of their loan. And I think it was about time that we used it. It was there from the beginning. And I think it's good policy because I think it will encourage these people to pay their loans back. If they don't like it, then fine. Give us our money back and then you can spend your money on each other as much as you like. But I think it's also good politics because I think the people need to see that Washington is aware that there is this sense in the country that the fat cats are getting taken care of and Main Street's getting left behind.
Pat Brady, a Republican, your reaction?
It's good populist politics. Now, these folks got money from taxpayers and were entitled to oversee what they're doing. But I think the bigger threat is that they were trying to extend this, or they were talking about extending this to organizations that didn't get bailout money. And I think that is something that it's not something we should be engaged in. I think it all just – the bigger picture is here. I prefer a more limited role of government.
Do you agree with the second part of that, Pat Cotter? That,
well,
again, maybe this, the extension to companies that didn't accept federal dollars.
Well, I don't think that's been proposed by the administration yet. If some kind of proposal like that came down, I'd have to look and see what their legal basis for it is. I don't think, as a general rule, I can just tell people in the economy what they can make. Having said that, we are getting to a place where the economy is getting so sophisticated and intertwined with the government. If these big companies are going to say that they're too big to fail and it's government's responsibility to do something to keep them from failing, then there's got to be some strings attached. Absolutely. Hey, if my nephew comes and wants me to bail him out financially, there's going to be some strings attached. And I think the government has a right to do the same thing with companies.
Why didn't those who were involved in this process, the congressional process, Democrats certainly in leadership, but certainly Republicans were weighing in because the bailouts began when George Bush was president of the United States. Why did they have such a tin ear on this subject? Why did they not put some strings, at least strings attached to compensation for their leaders? Why did they do that from the get-go? Are they so out of touch, Pat?
Yeah, I think they are. They completely missed it.
Both parties?
Both parties. There was a complete failure of both parties in this respect to not regulate this. I'm a very much a limited government guy, but when we're doling out that kind of money, they should have done it up front, and they didn't. And then and actually, I think Chris Dodd and mm-hmm. some people got in trouble with it, with the statements right. they made afterwards, because everybody was fully aware, Geithner on down, that this was going on, and they did nothing about it. It was a total failure of our government.
No, I agree. I think that there was a bit of a tenure. I also think, though, it's important to put yourself back in the moment. And I say this on behalf of the Republicans and the Democrats who are dealing with it. They were dealing with what they perceived at the time to be an absolutely emergency situation where action was mandatory to prevent possibly a second Great Depression. And they were being told by people with a lot of knowledge about these things that if you don't save these companies, if you don't step in now, if you don't infuse huge amounts of money quickly, you are going to risk putting the entire country into another depression. And it's not to excuse them, but I think it is an explanation for why they were more focused on getting the infusion of money to prop up these companies to prevent the second Great Depression than they were, and they should have been, more concerned about making sure that if we get through this, the taxpayers are going to get paid back timely.
In addition to the compensation issue, which is, again, very, you know, this is a very popular decision. The other piece of this is because you had some of these companies literally behind the eight ball, and again, the economy of the United States and the world was really teetering on the brink. We know this at this moment. But when you have someone in that position, it seems to me you can make some very significant demands. And one of the other demands above and beyond compensation was, how much of the money that you get are you going to loan, Mr. Banker?
Right.
What has happened to those loans? Because the economy still suffers today because loans are still not being made. And a lot of taxpayers who are furious about this, they're running businesses that could use some help.
I agree. And I agree with Pat that there was a very urgent time. But this just to me underscores why we want to keep government out of business. The regulators failed on this, but once you inject government into anything, it's not going to be done like business would run it. And they didn't pay attention to the compensation. They didn't pay attention to where the money was going to be used. And now we're cleaning the mess up a little bit.
Well, unfortunately, the problem with that analysis is that we had to get involved. Remember, the crisis came because we let business run things. Business brought us to the crisis. Government had to step in to correct what business had brought about.
Well, I think the crisis, without due respect, my partner Pat, was as much a failure of the regulatory framework, and this is a Republican issue,
right.
Of the regulators as much as it was of business. I think it was more of a failure of the regulators than it was a business, although business had its problem.
Well, I'm glad you hear you say it, Pat. I'm going to have to get a tape of this show. Pat is speaking up for the regulators. It seems to me, Pat.
No, I'm saying they were incompetent. I'm not saying I want more regulation.
Right, but you wanted them to do their job right.
And they didn't.
Right. And the point is that the answer then is to do your job right. It's not to say leave it to the market, because if the regulators don't regulate, then what you have is an unregulated market. An unregulated market brought us to the crisis. Government had to step in to fix it.
We have to pause. 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. From coast to coast and border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago. From Bakersfield, California to Boston, Massachusetts, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. We've got callers on the line. Let's head to Bob listening to us in Greenville, Tennessee on WNOX. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Okay.
Well, listen, I was listening to y'all bantering back and forth to the blame, but I really don't believe the basis of the debacle was business. Business would have never by itself done what Ginnie Mae and Freddie Mac did, which gave out nationwide over several years tens of thousands of big loans to people that they knew could never afford them, because everyone should have a home. $300,000 loans to someone making $30,000 a year, it was inevitable. And when it all came together and it was too late, it snowballed into a crisis. That's what caused this. Not regulation. It was too much regulation. I think deregulation in business sense would have prevented it.
Let's get reaction from our guest, Pat Brady.
I don't want to confuse regulation with the role of the regulators. I don't believe there should be more I believe there should be less regulation. I'm talking about the people that were responsible for overseeing this in the non-Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac world, and the other markets dropped the ball. I agree with the caller what he said about the mortgage, the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They were forewarned in 2005 this was going to happen. They didn't do anything about it.
I think you're missing the point. The point was that it was all of the private banks that bundled up these toxic mortgages, these no good mortgages, and started trading them as though they had some value. And they created a false market to make a lot of money for the middlemen. And that wasn't government, and it wasn't Ginnie Mae, and it wasn't Fannie Mae. That was a lot of big banks, and they made billions, and they were very smart. But that's the market, and you can't have the market just run wild. Let me just say this. You know, when you've only got four cars in town, maybe you don't need a street light, and maybe you don't need a traffic cop. But as you get more cars and things get more complicated, bigger, more sophisticated, more complicated, you need more traffic regulation. The same things happened in our markets. We have such sophisticated, clever people in the markets now, and they create derivatives and everything else, and it's just too crazy. And you can't leave it to the market because the market can't handle it. You need a traffic cop. You need some reasonable regulation.
Let's go to Dean in Austin, Texas, listening to us on KLBJ. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I love the show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask your guests whether or not they think that the regulations, there's a particular area in the commodities and futures exchange where we have some of these commodities being shorted by big banks to levels that really are unreasonable, in my opinion. I think a lot of experts also agree with that. And you have the CFTC chairman currently talking about implementing lower position limits by these banks. But I think like with J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, you see a lot of shorting of like, say, silver and gold commodities just way beyond the amount that anyone, it's like the top four shorters own like 40% of the short position or just really unreasonable amounts. And I think it's really almost a crime in progress right now. And I was wondering if they were aware of that and they think that there should be more highlights put on the current issue so that we don't see something like another problem going ahead in the future and then they ask for a bailout when they, get on the wrong side of it ultimately.
Let's let Pat Brady tackle that first.
Well, I think the answer historically was that we didn't lose it on the non-regulated industries. The bailouts weren't there. It's the more regulated industries that were bailed out. So if these people want to take risks, we just need to separate the regulated out from the non-regulated and let the risk people take the risk. That's what the country's all about. And if they're doing this, I mean, and there are a very comprehensive set of laws that govern all this. We don't need any more laws. We just need better and more astute enforcement of them.
I wouldn't disagree that we need better and more astute enforcement. I think that's always true. I would say this, though. One of the problems is that I don't know that we can kind of put everything in amber and freeze it and say, well, if you're a regulated industry as of 2009, then you're regulated. But if you're not, then it's the Wild West. The fact is that what the last couple of years have shown us is that even unregulated companies, industries, activities can have a profound national impact. The question is, how do you deal with that? I don't think we can put our head in the sand and just trust to the invisible hand of the free market anymore. And I think that's what the last 2 years have shown us.
All right, let's go to Matt in Petoskey, Michigan, listening to us on Sirius XM Radio. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was just wanting to comment on the fact that, you know, people want to talk about the fact that they didn't regulate beforehand. And a perfect example of where they failed us was a longtime friend of the family applied to get a loan to fix the roof on his house recently. Lived in the home for over 15 years, never missed a payment, you know, everything's been on time. Tries to get a loan to fix the house, and they said, no, we just can't do it right now. And he said, well, if I can't get a new roof, you know, I'm going to have to walk away. There's no way this roof's going to hold out another winter. And the bank tells him, well, then walk away. That's fine, just walk away. And, you know, that's a shame that someone's got to walk away from a home because they can't get a loan when they've done right by their payments when, you know, other people are the ones that screwed this problem up by getting in over their head on something they should have known they can't afford.
Well, I think, you know, we talked at the beginning of the program, you know, the anger that is out there First of all, the bailout of the banks and the automobile companies was an extremely unpopular thing, notwithstanding the fact that had we not done, you know, the you know, AIG, you know, maybe some of these big banks would have absolutely collapsed, and we would be talking about absolute collapse of the economy of the country, and far worse than we are now. We would be far angrier today had we not done something than if we had done something. But again, the anger is out there. Then on top of the anger, you have the story about the compensation. And then you have the story that you've told, probably multiplied by millions of times, the fact that people thought that when you were bailing out the banks were going to be making loans to small business people and to people like your friend who wants to repair their home. But that hasn't happened. And even at this moment, if you talk to any of the members of Congress, if we had members of Congress here, they wouldn't be able to answer it. They would not be able to answer the question. I mean, so I go back to something that we asked earlier. If you're taking money from the government, how much of a stick should the government provide and say, listen, if we're going to give you, $150 billion in a bailout, you've got to spend $125 billion in providing loans. Why couldn't and why don't they do that?
There's no reason we couldn't have, and as we've already discussed, they should have. I think they're trying to now. I think if you listen to Mr. Weinberg, who is the – I don't know what the phrase is this week. I understand we're not supposed to call him the pay czar anymore. He doesn't like czar. So the paymaster general,
as you called
him. But he talked about the fact that when he's talking to these banks who he's limiting and cutting back on their compensation, they're saying, well, what do we have to do to get you off our back? He says, one, pay the people back, but two, start making some loans. There's a program also that the administration put into effect, I think just in the last 2 weeks, to encourage banks that are receiving TARP money to make more loans. But I just want to make one point.
But also the other thing, what he said was this gets into how he wants to tie compensation.
Right.
He wants to tie compensation on the long-term success of a company or a bank.
Right.
Well, the long-term success of a bank may fly in the face of someone who wants to make a loan now. Maybe it's the best interest of that bank to do, we'll do a little bit this year and a little bit next year and a little bit next year. Maybe that helps their long-term books better.
This just underscores my belief that the government should stay out. This is an emergency circumstance, but once you go down this slope of having government bureaucrats and czars and appointees making these kind of decisions, it's never good. And in the bailout and the way they handle it, whether it was necessary or not, was completely inept, and we're paying the price now.
I also think, frankly, that the anger from these issues have built up the anger that is out there against healthcare.
In the GM, exactly. And the GM bailout was, if you look at the political side of that, that's union payback. That's not necessarily something we had to do. To bail out GM, I don't think so. And I think you saw probably much more anger on the GM bailout than you did on the initial bailout because it didn't have to be done.
Well, let me point something out. I think one of the reasons that banks aren't making small loans, I think it's important to step back and remember – banks didn't get in trouble, and they didn't have to be bailed out because the loans they made to people to buy that house that the person couldn't afford, the mortgage went bad. That's not what drove individual banks into trouble. Those failures on those loans created problems for the people who were trading bundles of hundreds and thousands and millions of those little loans.
Yeah, but the loans were bad from the get-go.
Right, but the point is, what happened is that those were the people that created the problem with those small loans. The problem for the small banks, I think, is that they are in a state of shock. They had a near-death experience, and they are very concerned. And the caller makes a good point. The problem is that you've got banks now who everybody's saying, here we all are around the table talking about how, boy, you made a lot of loans to small people who really couldn't afford them. Well, now small people go to the banks and say, I want a loan. And the bank's like, hey, God, that's what got us in trouble in the first place. Well, and they're saying, no, wait, no, I'm a good loan. I'm not like that bad person. Well, the banks are a little traumatized. And I'm not defending them, but I think you have to understand. They've had this near-death experience because of these bad small loans. And then everybody now is screaming at them, do more small loans.
Well, historically, this is the Barney Frank crew that was promoting this 10 years ago, that everybody needs to have a house regardless of their ability to pay for it. I think this is another example of the government sticking its nose in this more than they should have. And these loans, a lot of these loans were bad, and these people shouldn't have gotten these loans.
But the government didn't give them the loans.
The government guaranteed them. They guaranteed them, and they promoted them. And there's a lot of bad policy.
Bundled them up and traded them like they were hog bellies or something.
That's a separate issue, though.
No, but
there's the underwriting process, and then there's the risk issue.
No,
but you know, you made a point. That Barney Frank and Chris Dodd may have, they were the gatekeepers that weren't watching the gates. The reality is, I think the anger that's in the country now, it isn't exclusively against Barney Frank
no,
and the Democrats.
No, absolutely not.
It's across the board.
No, I agree with you.
Because they feel that a lot of Republicans screwed up in not watching the chicken coop when they were in charge, and certainly in the early days when the money was being passed out in the first place.
I agree
and
with
the
that.
Bailout occurred under a Republican.
That's right. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Portland, Oregon to Poughkeepsie, New York, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Tonight we have one Republican. We have one Democrat. They share a couple of things in common. Once upon a time, they were each a assistant United States attorney in different jurisdictions, and we're going to be talking about that. So part of their life was going after the bad guys. They are now, and by the way, if you recall that they were on this program several months ago, well, since that time, they are now work for the same firm in Chicago, Barnes and Thornburg. Our Democrat is Patrick Cotter. He was a assistant United States attorney in Brooklyn, New York. And one of your claims to fame is you were on the lead prosecuting team that got John Gotti, the noted crime syndicate figure, and sent him to prison. And I want to hear more about that as the program unfolds. Patrick Brady also joins us. He was an expert in white-collar crime and primarily working in a variety of jurisdictions in California and also in Illinois. And also you were with the state's attorney's office in the county of Cook, where we do this program as well.
Yes.
And you guys are now partners.
Yes, and we're good
see
friends.
Each other around the water cooler.
That's right.
In
argue
politics.
And you come out of the argue on the air.
That's right.
One of the things, but we're going to go back to calls in just a moment, but I want to kind of, broaden the discussion because, again, the level of anger is, I think, real and it's deep in the country for a variety of reasons. And a sense that I get from people who call this program and from people that I run into, on the street is that people feel, whether it is in these big government cases that we're talking about or actions of government or in their daily lives, that bad behavior is being rewarded. And what people are angry about is it's an incompetent, car company. They're being rewarded. Everybody's being rewarded for bad behavior. And one of the things most, at least of my generation, were taught is, you shouldn't reward bad behavior. If you're a parent, that's sort of parenting 101. You shouldn't reward bad behavior. Your guys, you've spent much of your professional life going after bad guys because of their behavior. And I want to get your general sense about whether you agree with this as being one of the maybe the causes of the intense anger that's in the country, that people really do feel that people are getting away with either murder or incompetence or you name it. Pat Cotter.
Well, I understand it, and I think there's a certain, as everybody says, for every misconception, there's a core of truth. I think that the reality is that in life, in all of our lives, and we all know this individually, but it applies to economies and countries. In life, sometimes you cannot act purely in the way that your gut would tell you to act. You have to act more practically. And the reality is that when the economic crisis hit, we did not have the option to simply stand there and wag our finger at all of these financial institutions and say, you acted badly, you were very foolish, and now you must all die and then take the economy down with us. That simply wasn't an option. So the question is, if you're not going to do that, if you're going to say, no, we have to act practically, then you do what you have to do. It doesn't mean that you're rewarding them. It means you're doing what you have to do to save an economy upon which all the rest of us, all the good people who didn't cause the economic crisis, depend. And unfortunately, when we save everybody on the boat, some of the bad people are going to be saved too, but we have to do it to save the boat. And that's what happened. It doesn't mean, as we started out our discussion this evening, it doesn't mean that when we have a chance to cut back on some of these ridiculous salaries and bonuses people are making, we don't do it. And I think what it has to do, it has to inform us going forward. But I understand the anger, but I think people also have to realize that just as they do in their lives, you sometimes have to act more practically than sort of from an emotional, moral perspective.
Pat Brady.
I think the anger is not necessarily from the bailout of, you know, a year ago or 13 months ago. I think the anger is in the daily addition to the debt. I mean, a $1 trillion health care, the 50 or $500 million, billion-dollar bailout of whatever it was at GM. I think the anger started maybe with the bailout, but I think it's gotten worse every day. This administration comes up with a new government program that we can't pay for it. I think that's where you see a lot of the anger in the electorate.
No, I disagree. I don't think that people are angry about the budget. I'm sure there are. I mean, there's some people angry because everybody else doesn't agree the earth is flat. That's not the point. I think most people are angry because they don't feel that for all the money that's been spent that they're seeing enough change in their personal situation.
Right. The stimulus didn't work.
Right.
The GM bailout's not working so far.
That's simply not true.
Like we see here, the incompetence of the payment of to these executives. All this that the government has done, all this big government action, all this big government money hasn't worked. And I think that's where the anger comes from. I do believe that people were angry early on about rewarding bad behavior, and I agree completely with what Pat's assessment was there. But I think the bigger anger and the numbers you see Obama tanking in the polls comes from the fact that they've been completely incompetent on everything they put their hands on the last 10 months.
Well, it's great to hear a Republican talk about presidents tanking in the polls when Bush was, what was it, like three?
He was out of office.
But the
President Obama's got to remember that he's been out of office for 10 months.
It's hilarious. Look, the point is it's totally ridiculous to talk about how all these things have failed. The stimulus has failed.
Well, it has failed. They promised. Keep it below 8%.
I'm sorry, Pat. Let me finish.
All right.
See, this is what happens around the water cooler. here's the point. The stimulus package, some of these other programs, were not designed to work in a matter of weeks. We got into this problem over the course of years and years. And if anybody thinks that you can turn that around in a few weeks or months, you're just not being realistic.
But here's one of the other frustrations where I think there is anger as it relates to the stimulus bill. And I certainly agree with you. You can't turn the ship around overnight or within a couple of months. But we had a couple of weeks ago, we had Gila Bronner on this program. She's a CPA. She studies how the various states are utilizing the money. The fact is, when they came out with the stimulus plan, this is after the bailout plan. Also, no strings attached, no rules, no regulations.
Oh, that's not even close to being true.
They didn't have it in place. Then why is such a small amount of that stimulus money out in working right now?
Because we're not going to waste it. It's hilarious to me. People say, well, you know, government wastes money and they're not, you know, the stimulus isn't working. And then they say, and why haven't you spent all that money already?
No, wait a minute.
I'm not suggesting all of it.
Look, for a couple of things. First of all, we're spending it in a way which is designed to avoid all the horror stories about waste and corruption and frittering it away. And that takes time and thought. And the money is being spent in ways that we hope will have the desired effect.
No, wait a minute.
I get to finish the answer. This is not science. There's no template. You can't go to the playbook and see, oh, this is exactly how you spend the money at this rate and in this way, and this way you'll get the jobs. There's a little bit of feeling our way along. But it's hilarious to me because if they had put 70% of the money out by now, Pat would be sitting here and he'd have a little piece of paper and he'd be reading me stories from around the country of abuse and fraud with the relief money and how the stimulus money was being wasted. And it would be true. And it would have been wasted because we rushed it out there. If I have to choose, I think go slow, do it right, and don't just throw money at the problem, which, by the way, Democrats are always being accused of. So I don't have any problem at all with the fact that it's taking a while because I think that's the only way real problems get fixed. They don't get fixed overnight, and I think adults understand that.
Christina Romer, the chairman of the Economic Council of Advisors, said today 14% of the money is out, and the stimulative effect is as good as it's going to get. So whatever you talk about, the waste, fraud, and abuse, this is the person he listens to
that Christine Romer said 14% and we're done?
No, she said most of the – and this is all over the news today. Most of the stimulative effect has taken place. Let's look what they promised. They promised it wouldn't get above 8% unemployment.
It was going to create jobs.
Who promised 8%?
The president.
No, he didn't.
Yes, he did.
He did not.
Joe
Biden
did, too.
He never promised it would not get above 8%.
But the goal
was simply not true. He had a goal.
Okay.
He never promised. No, Pat, there's a big difference between a promise and a goal.
But the promise, he said.
No, he didn't promise.
Okay, I'll agree with that, the goal. The thing is, and they were going to create, I think, 2.5. The goal was to create 2.5 million jobs. They've lost 3.5. So the goals,
And they've only spent 14% of the
money. The point is, the goals of this stimulus that was supposed to save us haven't been met, and I think that's where a lot of the anger comes from. Plus, the cosmetology school that got the $2.5 million. I mean, we can go on those stories.
Right.
We
got
to go. Let's go to Carl in Chicago, listening on WLS. You're on the air coast to coast.
Hi. Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi. My big beef is that we shouldn't have never gave a bailout to the automakers in the first place. They should have just, you know, kind of, I hate to say the word, dropped dead because of their very poor management, and they don't build vehicles that people want. You know,
well, let's stop there because you probably represent a lot of people that are going to call. But again, Pat Cotter made a brief comment about it a little bit earlier. But repeat it. In your view, what would have happened had we just absolutely let the automobile companies go?
I mean, obviously you'd have had hundreds of thousands, millions of people who would have been affected by that directly. They would have lost their jobs, their health care, their retirement benefits, everything. You know, it sort of depends whose ox is getting gored. If it's an industry that your part of the country depends on to survive, then you think it's worth saving. If you don't happen to live in a part of the country where that industry is necessary for the economy to survive, then you think let them drop dead. I think that if you're running the entire economy, you have to think about all those things. And obviously, if you're not in that part of the country, you're not going to think it's that important.
Let's go to Tinley Park. John is on the line. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm angry at the incompetence of both parties. I'm angry at the incompetence of the execution of the TARP bailout, the GM bailout, the AIG bailout. The greatest quote I've ever heard was that communism restricts the ability to fail. Capitalism should, and by right, let things fail. My ox being gored? Yeah. You know, when I look at Wells Fargo that I owe $7,000 to, that they won't give me a home equity line or a refinance a house that I have, paid down pretty well because, well, we just...
That's why you're angry, and that's why we've got to go to a break. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and let's go back to golf. Let's go to George listening to us in Chicago on WLS. You're on the air coast to coast.
Yes, hi. Since you have two former district attorneys there, I'd be very interested in your thoughts on this. You talked about people getting away with things. Back in 1999, when Larry Sinclair came to Chicago, just by coincidence, he happened to use P. Mulfoney and the five-star limo service. What he couldn't possibly know back then was that the five-star limo service was the people that Tony Resco used for the sex and drugs part of his corruption schemes. And so when P. Mulfoney said he had somebody for Larry Sinclair to meet, and it happened to be Obama, he couldn't have possibly known that ahead of time.
I think you're going off on a specific case.
Well,
which
it's
we're gonna take a pass. But thank you very much. We're not looking for comments on specific cases because we don't know both sides of the cases. But I would like to ask, since we have two former U.S. attorneys with us, assistant United States attorneys, I want to get your reaction when you talk about getting away with it. What is going on in the Northern District of Illinois? Everyone listening to this program knows that the former governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich, has been indicted. Everyone knows that he's trying to get on every radio and television signal in the country to make his case. He's been very successful in doing that. People are still giving him airtime, unfortunately. But my question to you is, when he goes on the high visibility shows, how are those appearances playing in the inner circles of the U.S. Attorney's Office? How would you be reacting if someone who was under indictment was going out and getting the national exposure? And most importantly, would you be worried that he is poisoning the jury pool? Patrick Cotter.
Well, I have to tell you, my first reaction would probably be to buy a new DVR and just make sure that I get a copy of everything he says, because it's all usable in court. So on the one hand, I probably feel pretty good. But you have to be concerned, because it's clearly an overt attempt by the defense to influence the jury pool. And you know what? That happens to be improper. And his lawyers can mouth off all they want about how he's just trying to tell a side of the story. But we all know that if the government lawyers were going on TV, if the lead prosecutor was on a reality show in which he got to show what a good guy he is, they would be screaming bloody murder in court. And, well, they should. So it's unfair, but it's probably something that the government has decided it's not really in their interest to try and completely squelch. But it is unfair, I think, because if the government tried to do it, they'd be accused of trying to taint the jury pool, and I think rightly so. He's clearly trying to taint the jury pool. By the way, I think he'll fail, and I don't think it'll make any bit of difference at all in the outcome of the trial. But that's what I would be thinking if I was still at the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Pat Brady.
I agree completely with Pat. And the bad news for our former governor is his best buddy just pled guilty last week. He's cooperating. So I think the news is pretty tight around it. But I do agree. These appearances, and we just had this at a conference that we both attended, that they're trying to get that one or two jurors that are going to say, hey, this guy's a good guy, and he sticks up for the little people. Read his book. It says the same thing. But I don't think it's going to work.
Well, by all the way, for those listening around the country who may not know, is the former deputy governor, Lon Monk, who was his law school buddy. He pleaded guilty this past week.
He did.
Agreed that he's going to turn evidence against Rod Blagojevich, tell what he knows. But the story they paint is probably the most disgusting story of corruption that I have read. You know, we do this program from Chicago, so we know corruption inside and out. This is one of the most egregious examples of basically three guys getting together to figure out how they're going to screw the system. Not after they got the power. They wanted to run for governor so they could screw the system. That's what it's about. It's a conspiracy of buddies getting together, of which Rod Blagojevich is one of them, for the sole purpose of running for office, getting elected to screw the taxpayers of Illinois.
Unfortunately, that's a common story in the Northern District of Illinois.
It is.
Bruce, you'll forgive me, but I think it's important. I am a defense attorney. I do think it's important to point out these are allegations. He's yet to be found guilty. He is entered a not guilty plea, and he's going to have his day in court. And God love him.
No, but Lon Monk's allegations. This is the way it was, and I accepted this when happened.
That's what made it unique.
Of course, Rod Blagojevich is going to say he did nothing wrong, because that's what he does.
The funniest conversation that we're never going to see is when the government rests their case and they make the decision that Rod Blagojevich is going to testify.
Right.
How'd you like to be his counsel? Tell him, Rod, you can't say anything.
Let's go to Brent, listening to us in Ontario, Oregon on KBOI. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I really appreciate your guys' conversation on Sunday afternoons. I listen to it all the time.
Terrific.
One thing that one of the fellows said there that I wanted to point out, he indicated that he thought there wasn't a template for economic recovery based on a government-funded model. But in my thinking, there is a template for economic recovery that was an environment created by Ronald Reagan. And I think that cuts the government out of so much control over it, and that's why everybody's steering clear of it up until 1999, when the Glass-Steagall Act was unanimously throughout Congress voted to repeal. And that's when things started going south, and it was Democrats, Republicans alike, and it was the biggest lobbying effort ever in Washington, D.C., and it's a follow the money sort of a deal, but that's where we ended up, and that's why we need to clean house now. Thank you.
Okay, listen, on that note, we are out of time for hour number one. Thanks very much for your call. Phone calls and lines will remain open at 1-800-723-8029. In the next hour, we're going to be talking about a disturbing thing that's happening in the country, and that is because of some of the discourse, which some people think is getting a little bit too rough. Threats against the president have increased by 400%. We're going to be talking about the Secret Service and their protecting job of the President of the United States in the next hour of Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back in a few minutes. If you're watching us on radio, you're watching us on television. We'll see you next week. Author of In the President's Secret Service. That's a book looking into the actions and the history of the Secret Service of the United States. And Mr. Kessler, nice to have you with us on our broadcast.
Thank you for having me.
We have reached out because of not only the success of your book, but last week the Boston Globe reported that a new internal Congressional Research Service report says that there's been an unprecedented number of death threats against President Obama, and that the Secret Service is insufficiently funded and staffed to deal with them. And there have been an increase of threats against the president in excess of 400% over his predecessor, George Bush. And before we get into the specifics of your book, I want to give you an opportunity to sort of respond. How alarmed should we be about the Secret Service and how crunched they are with their job at the moment?
Well, very alarmed. My book reported the 400% increase in threats, which is a lot of which are racially based, unfortunately. That compares with 3,000 threats a year against President Bush. But at the same time, my book also exposed the fact that the Secret Service has been cutting corners since the Department of Homeland Security took it over in 2003. So it's not just related to President Obama. It's been a problem that's extended back, and it includes not even doing basic magnetometer or metal detection screening at events, or else shutting them down early. For example, when Joe Biden threw the first pitch at the Orioles game last April in Baltimore, the Secret Service did absolutely no screening, and both the Baltimore field office and his own detail were outraged. And this thing has been going on, as I said, since 2003. In addition, they've also cut back on the size of counter-assault teams. They're not keeping up to date with the latest firearms, and they're not even allowing agents enough time to do regular firearms requalification or physical training. So it really risks an assassination, and of course the question is, how could they do that? Well, it's like any other scandal in the government. It's hard to comprehend, but it's a combination of the Secret Service now being part of Homeland Security, where there are 21 other national security agencies competing for funds. So they really are way under budget. They only have a budget of $1.4 billion, which is almost nothing. It's about equal to the price of half a stealth bomber. And yet, what could be more important than protecting the president? And also, it's just a mentality that the management has, not the agents. The agents are very dedicated and brave, and they'll take a bullet for the president. But the management has this, you know, really callous attitude of, we make do with less. We don't need to get more money. Everything is fine. And we really risk an assassination.
Tell us more, if you will. You alluded to maybe racial-based threats against the president. What can you tell us about the growth of white supremacist groups and others that are organized that may have a hatred towards the president?
It is largely white supremacist groups. It's not people who are really politically involved. It's not the Tea Party people or the Town Hall people. It's people who are just simple racists, and they have been making these threats. The Secret Service has to check out each one. Of course, a lot of them are not really serious, but they still, these people still have to be watched and interrogated, and the Secret Service has to determine, you know, just how serious this threat might be. The Secret Service puts threats into three different categories. Class 3 is the most serious, where they think it is a serious threat, and where also there's a belief that the person could carry it out. And in those cases, the Secret Service will not only investigate, but and possibly bring charges, because it is a federal crime to threaten the president, but also keep tabs on that person, probably for life, including checking in on what they're doing every few months. If the president is coming to that person's hometown, the Secret Service will show up at the individual's home and tell him to stay away from the president, and tell him that he'll be watched, and he will be watched until the president leaves town. Whereas a Class 1 threat is where some person blurts out in a bar, "I wish I could kill the president." Secret Service goes into it, finds there's no real serious basis to it, but certainly just being investigated and interrogated is probably going to scare that person out of his wits. And, of course, besides that, the Secret Service does the security around the White House, and also that includes the uniformed division who specifically guard the White House. They have a lot of high-tech devices there, of course, sensors, and on the president's desk is an ornament, which is the presidential seal, and if the president turns it over, that sounds an alarm, which brings agents running with guns drawn.
Now, in addition to protecting the President of the United States, there are 32 other government officials that are covered. Does that include every member of the cabinet, or does it extend beyond them?
It includes some of the top members of the cabinet, the people who are in the direct line of succession, and also some White House people, such as the chief of staff. That's someone who got protection after 9/11. Others, like the press secretary, have partial protection. They may be just picked up and dropped off by the Secret Service in the morning and at night. Michelle Obama's mother has protection because she lives in the White House and she could be, captured. When Cheney was vice president, his children and even grandchildren were protected. And you can see why, because all of them could be targets, and you just can't take a chance, in my opinion.
And former presidents as well?
Yeah. Bill Clinton is the last president to receive protection for life, along with his spouse. George H.W. Bush and others after him received protection for 10 years. And also that can be extended by the sitting president if there's some need. For example, Obama has extended protection on Jenna and Barbara Bush, for example.
Based on what you've revealed in your book, what has been the reaction to what you were describing as a potential problem in protecting the president? How has Congress reacted to it?
Well, there have been some inquiries on the Hill. They're looking into it, but that's not really going to solve the problem, because in the end, you need, I think, a doubling of the budget. You need an outside director who will not have this mentality of denial, and that just has not happened. The Secret Service, is very effective at covering up their deficiencies and blowing smoke and mirrors, and impressing everyone that they really have everything under control. And so far, nothing really has changed, and it's really a tragedy, because if there is another assassination, there'll be another Warren Commission, and they'll, point the finger of blame at the Secret Service, but by then it'll be too late. There's also a very high attrition rate. Because,
well, let me just stop here for a second. We do have to go to a commercial break. 1-800-723-8029, the title of the... United States. We're talking about that. And Patrick Cotter, who's our Democrat, former Assistant United States Attorney for in Bronx.
Brooklyn,
I'm sorry. Brooklyn. Well, put John Gotti away in prison. And you've got a question for Mr. Kessler.
I do. Ron, the book sounds fascinating. I'm curious, Ron, when the rhetoric about the president being, you know, supposedly illegitimate because he was born somewhere else or all these things, and when the teabaggers were out there with the signs talking about the tree of liberty needing to be nourished by blood periodically, there was a lot of talk that that kind of rhetoric and that kind of public positioning might be having some effect on certain people in society. It might be encouraging them to think that there was something justified in attacking the president physically. What's your sense of that? Do you think that that's contributed to the problem, or is it really not a major factor?
I don't think it is a major factor. The people who are making these threats are just, you know, pure racists. They don't need any encouragement. I think that's quite different from, you know, people who just get out of hand. And of course, we saw the same thing on the left with President Bush, people who said that Bush was behind 9/11 and Bush was Hitler. You have those fringe elements on both sides of the spectrum. Also the people who ran around with loaded weapons at Obama events, although they may be idiots, and they are, in my opinion, were not a threat.
We agree.
The Secret Service, you know, first of all, did keep watch on them. If they got anywhere near the event, they would be detained or arrested. And they were exercising their Second Amendment rights, just like these idiots on both sides who exercise their First Amendment rights, repugnant though what they say may be, it really does not impinge on Obama's security.
Ron, you have done written books on the FBI and the CIA, and you certainly have done a great deal of research and writing in the intelligence communities, and you've obviously befriended many who work in the Secret Service. What makes a Secret Service agent special? Is it the same type of person that goes into these other services, or is it something unique?
It really is unique because they really do pledge to take a bullet for the president. And what kind of person would do that? You know, it has to be very dedicated, a patriot. Their attitude is that they're not protecting the individual; they're protecting the presidency. They're very impressive people. The FBI tends to look at Secret Service agents with more admiration than any other law enforcement that they deal with.
There was controversy, however, during the impeachment hearings, because there was certainly an effort to try to get the Secret Service maybe to confirm some of the allegations against Bill Clinton. What can you say about that period in the service's history?
The Secret Service has always had the attitude that if they start talking about the personal lives of the people they protect, that will jeopardize their function because those people will not want them nearby, and that will jeopardize security. And so that was the basis that the Secret Service used to try to resist testifying. They lost on that on those grounds. In the end, they really didn't see very much anyway, as far as Clinton was concerned. They sort of suspected that Monica was up to something because she just seemed around too much, too friendly, but they never actually saw anything. In my book, I do go into quite a bit of detail about what the Secret Service does see behind the scenes, as the subtitle indicates. And on the one hand, you know, I think that argument is a legitimate one about security. But on the other hand, first of all, people presidents, for example, who engage in extramarital affairs really open themselves up to blackmail. And so it's just as well that they should fear disclosure by the Secret Service. In addition, I think anybody who wants to lead a double life like that should not be running for office, and I think when we choose our politicians, we should take into account character as well as track record, and not necessarily how well people do on TV or even what they promise sometimes. So that's where I come out on the argument.
We have a caller on the line. Let's go to Charles listening to us in New York on Sirius Radio. Go ahead.
Hi, Bruce. How you doing?
Okay.
Thanks, as always, for taking my call. Appreciate it. I had a question for, well, the, both the panel and for Mr. Kessler. You asked Mr. Kessler what the reaction had been in Congress and Secret Service or wherever. He mentioned some reaction in Congress, but he didn't mention the Secret Service's reaction. Now, a couple of days ago, he did an interview with Wolf Blitzer, where Blitzer directly questioned him about the fact that, according to Mr. Blitzer, Secret Service has issued a statement stating that the 400 times normal level of threats is actually no longer true, that, in fact, the level of threats has fallen down to a level that is fairly typical and fairly close to that of George W. Bush. Mr. Blitzer asked Mr. Kessler, well, what are your sources? And Mr. Kessler said, I have alternate sources in which I trust, or something like that. And then the time ran out on the interview. So I'd be really interested to know exactly why the Secret Service is disagreeing with Mr. Kessler's figures and what Mr. Kessler's sources are, or at least why he thinks they're so unimpeachable that they trump any statements from the Secret Service.
The Secret Service has been putting out these not-for-attribution comments about the book, one of which is that threats were not up, threats were up while he was campaigning, or threats were up as soon as he took office, but they're not up now. But first of all, the Secret Service Director Mark Sullivan testified in March that, in fact, threats are up substantially under Obama, and that as a result they've had to hire more people to analyze. So the Secret Service is not giving the true story. And secondly, the Secret Service told reporters, again, not for attribution, that the reason that they didn't do magnetometer screening at the Joe Biden event was that the fact that he would be there was not announced beforehand. But anybody can just do a very simple Google check and find that, in fact, that was announced a day before his appearance, and it was on over 50 newspapers, AP, et cetera. So that's the level of response that we've been getting out of the Secret Service.
The testimony you referred to in March, was that on the record in open session, or was that a leak?
That's right. March 23rd, open session in Congress.
Can you read a quote from it?
Beg your pardon?
Can you read a quote from it, from his testimony?
I don't have it here, but, you know, it was March 23rd on the Hill. If you do a search for Mark Sullivan and the testimony on the Hill in March, you'll find it.
Thanks very much for your call, Charles. I want to go back. When should people become fearful of what, let's say, loose talk, whether it's some guy in a bar? I mean, how seriously should they take people if they make derogatory statements against the president?
It is a tricky situation because the Secret Service is always trying to distinguish between free speech and an actual threat that may be against the law. But if it's a direct threat, you know, I'm going to kill the president, then that is a threat, as opposed to, Obama is a horrible guy and maybe someone will kill him someday. That's not considered a real threat. But the Secret Service is very good at sorting these things out. And it does have a lot of leeway as well. You just can't take a chance, for example, when you see a person in a crowd who may look like a possible assassin. The Secret Service has a profile in their minds of the lone gunman kind of assassin, someone who just does not fit in. He may be smiling when everyone else is not, or vice versa. He may be wearing an overcoat in the summer. He may be sweating. In those cases, they'll just grab the guy or woman and pat him down, and very often they do find weapons. The Secret Service cooperated on this book, and when I interviewed Nicholas Trotta, the head of security, of protection, he started talking about how important magnetometer screening is. Not only does it find weapons, but it acts as a deterrent, because, of course, anybody who sees a magnetometer is going to run in the other direction if they intend to kill the president. And then I asked him, and this is all on the record, well, what about the times when you don't do that, or when you shut it down early? And he started defending it and saying, well, it's okay if we let people up to a higher level of a stadium without screening them. Well, you can imagine how quickly someone at a higher level or 20 terrorists could run down and kill a president or throw grenades before the Secret Service could do a thing.
It's scary stuff. And listen, I thank you very much for joining us tonight. I know you have to go to another appointment. Again, the author is Ron Kessler. He's also the Washington Bureau Chief for Newsmax, former reporter for the Washington Post, and author of numerous books. The latest is In the President's Secret Service, Behind the Scenes with Agents in the Line of Fire and the Presidents They Protect. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago with our guests, and we're going to be talking about medical marijuana and the fact that the U.S. Justice Department is no longer going to pursue those, at least the federal aspect, of smoking pot in certain states, back shortly from Chicago, of a federal statute.
That's right. That's right. I didn't mention when Mr. Kessler was on the line, but there is a federal crime which makes it illegal to knowingly and intentionally utter a threat against the president. You don't have to take any further action to be in violation of the law. So I think it's pushing the envelope a little bit on where the line is between speech and crime. But I will say, as a citizen, I'm a little more comfortable that the Secret Service has the ability at least to detain people in that circumstance and at least figure it out. But be careful.
I was surprised that several months ago when Squeaky Fromm, who attempted to shoot Gerald Ford, that she was basically let out. She spent a lot of time in prison, but that was a unique situation that I think goes back to 1975, when within 1 month, President Ford went to California twice, and twice within 30 days, two women tried to shoot him. I mean, it was absolutely, and he was sort of, you know, he wasn't known as riling a lot of people up, not terribly.
That's why I wanted to ask Ron if he thinks that they're tailing Squeaky. She's out.
I would. I mean, because she was.
She was a Manson,
She was a Manson follower, and I was just about to tell our in-studio guests about one of the more interesting interviews I had years ago. Sarah Jane Moore, who was one of the women who attempted to, actually took a couple of pot shots at Gerald Ford outside the San Francisco Hotel in San Francisco, and it's the famous picture where Donald Rumsfeld, who was his chief of staff, literally jumps on top of Ford, pushes him into the limousine, and they hightail out of downtown San Francisco. And Don Rumsfeld had told that story to me, but Sarah Jane Moore, she was incarcerated. She was found guilty. She was incarcerated, and then she escaped from the federal prison in Alderson, West Virginia. So she popped back into the news. This was several years after, the attempt on President Ford's life. And so I put out a request. I was doing a daily talk show at the time, and I was able to get an interview, a phone interview, with Sarah Jane Moore from her prison. And it was actually one of the most bizarre interviews I ever had, because she sounded very rational. She was a mother. She had young children, and she hated the president because she had become radicalized by the Symbionese Liberation Army and the Black Panthers, and she really got caught up in a lot of left wing politics in California. And so she went down with the sole purpose. She had the gun in her purse. She went down with the sole purpose that she wanted to assassinate Gerald Ford. So she's telling me this story. This is part of the interview.
I take it her lawyers weren't.
she had already been convicted.
Yeah, okay.
Horse was out of the barn on that one. Yeah.
I'm interviewing her when she just got back after being an escapee for, I think she was on her 15 hours, something like that. So she's telling me the story, and I said, And I waited there a long time, and he wasn't showing up. And she's talking very matter-of-factly. She says, and then I got, it was about 2:45, and I had to decide, should I go home and get my children, because they were coming home from school in about a half an hour? I've been waiting all day there to assassinate President Ford, but I was getting tired, and I thought, well, maybe I should go home and get my kids from school. So here is this woman explaining during this interview this dilemma she had. Well, am I going to assassinate the president, or am I going to go home and get my children to school?
You know, being a working mother is very difficult. And I think you've got your job, you're there, you're trying to do
is
it.
Is she still in?
You know, child care
She's,
issues.
Yeah, I think so. Or, you know, she might have passed away. Maybe somebody, Ben, do a search on that. Sarah Jane Moore. It seems to me that there's something in the back of my head that said that she may have ultimately died, but I think she may still be in office in West Virginia.
I wonder what you get out of the lockup. What do you do? I mean,
Well, she'll be on supervised release.
I mean, what do you do to survive? I mean,
get a job. Yeah,
it's not a resume filler.
Right. That's true. That's true. It's tough to get that job.
No.
Yeah.
I don't know. Squeaky for
question. You guys again involved in law enforcement. One of the things that Eric Holder said recently, the Attorney General of the United States, is that the Justice Department will no longer seek to prosecute people using, prescribing, or distributing pot for medical purposes as long as they're in compliance with local law. However, in some of the this involves 13 states where the use of medical marijuana is legal, but the Justice Department doesn't want to spend its resources and its time looking into these cases. Is that a good decision, Pat Brady?
You know what? It's on the big scheme of things, it's not very high up on priority. I don't think it's a good decision to not enforce laws. Eric Holder's decided to do that. And I don't buy the resource argument necessarily, but in the big scheme of things, this is another thing that comes out of the White House the last 4 or 5 months that don't seem to focus on the more important issues.
Pat Connor?
Oh, I think it's far out. just kidding. No, I actually think it's exactly focusing on the right issues. We don't have time when the states. I'm surprised my friend Pat would be against this. This is a respecting of states' rights. When the states decide to legalize marijuana for certain medical uses, I think when the federal government recognizes that we've got more important things to do, more important crimes to be prosecuting than that. I think that's an excellent decision and an excellent way to allocate federal law enforcement resources. So I think when we don't have enough money in Secret Service agents to protect the president and the cabinet, I think we can afford to let some folks smoking marijuana because they've got glaucoma not have to worry that the feds are going to arrest them. So I think it's a great decision.
But the reality is this is just political grandstanding. I don't think they were enforcing it anyway. It's a nice press pop for the left wing, and they can go back and they can be a campaign issue for them. I don't think it's a legitimate issue.
Yeah. You know, for a young man, you're very cynical, Pat.
Left wing that's interested in medical.
No, but I'm thinking, no. But I'm saying the enforcement the enforcement of it.
I have to differ with you. If you think back just a couple of years ago, the Reagan Justice Department, Bush Justice Department was in fact announcing that they were going to raid medical marijuana dispensaries in California. They were announcing it. They were trying to intimidate the state to back off of the licensing. So it's a real issue, and I think it's a policy decision. I don't think there's necessarily an absolutely right or wrong position, but I certainly think as a resource management issue, it was definitely the right call.
Is again, this goes well beyond obviously medical marijuana, but there are those that would suggest that this is. You know, the relaxing of this legislation is just a softening of the war against drugs. Is the war against drugs is that a worthy war to fight in your view?
Absolutely, and I agree with you. It's a softening, and I think that they better get serious about the drugs coming in on the border down there. So I don't think that they better soften this at all, because that's not only leads to drugs coming into the country, but the murders and the kidnappings and the things it has done to the economy in the Southwest. So.
I disagree completely. It has nothing to do with softening the war on drugs. I think the war is on crime, and drugs are one kind of crime. I don't think there's any benefit to talking about the war on drugs. And all drugs are not the same. And I think that if you are serious about a war, you have priorities and you have priority targets. And I think that there aren't a lot of DEA agents who want to be spending their time organizing raids on marijuana boutiques in San Francisco when they should be on the border.
And they haven't been.
Fighting,
that's why I think it's
politics. And that's why it's not a softening on the war on drugs, because what we're doing is we're saying we're serious about real drug problems, and we are not going to waste our time, resources, and money on nonsense like some locally grown marijuana up in California. By the way, the marijuana sold in these legal establishments is the sources are controlled by law. You cannot – they are not the product. They are not selling marijuana brought into the country illegally. So they are not part of that problem. I agree that's a terrible problem. The problem in Mexico right now is frightening beyond words. But I don't think it's an – I think it's very unfair to suggest that this is in any way a softening on the war against crime.
No, it's just – it's politics.
Mike in Waukegan, Illinois wants to join this discussion. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. I just like to throw this in here if I could. This pertains to the medical issue, if you will. This is a snippet here from a Catholic catechism, okay, that goes back to about the mid-20th century. It's the – or no, about 1937. This is from Radio Replies, and here it is verbatim. It says, "Is there any virtue in taking strong drink?" That's the question to the priest. The answer is, "That all depends upon the intention with which one takes it. If taken in moderation for the sake of health, so that one may the better fulfill his duties for the love of God, it's virtue to take it. If taken merely for the sake of taking it, such use of drink would not be virtuous." Now, I'm wondering, are all these people who go to taverns, are they out there drinking for medicinal reasons and for the love of God? Was that cop who beat up that female bartender half his size, was he drinking for that reason? I mean, the whole thing is it's the rank hypocrisy of this whole issue is so enormous. I don't even know where to begin sometimes. I really don't. Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
But the thing is, there's laws on the books. If you don't like the laws, change them, but you have to enforce them.
Right, but the laws in California, voted by the people in California and 13 other states, are different and say that they, like the caller, they see a difference between they think marijuana is a lot more like scotch than it is like heroin. So I think that's it.
And they also want to give basically doctors the right to determine whether medical marijuana really is, works.
Absolutely.
Back shortly from Chicago. When we come back, we'll talk a little more about the justice. Moore was released on December 31st of 2007 from federal prison. She served 32 years for her attempt on the life of President Gerald Ford. She is now 79 years old. She appeared on the Today Show on May 28th, in which was her first television appearance since leaving prison. She told Matt Lauer, "I'm glad that I didn't kill Ford, but I don't regret trying."
How did she get out with that statement? I thought parole was you've been re, you know, to help the – I guess the parole board didn't ask her that question.
No. It's under old federal law, parole is not – I mean, she was entitled to parole after a certain number of years, and she doesn't have to disavow her crime. They just have to make a determination that she is no longer a threat. So she can say, "I don't regret that I did it, but I would never do it again." And
that was half of it. Yeah, I don't regret it.
Yeah.
Sarah Jane Moore, she's alive, maybe not well, but she's alive. I was making the point of just sort of the absurdity and sort of the cavalier way in which she was answering questions for me.
Well, get her in and ask her.
Yeah,
that's
I'll
right.
Put back her on. Take two. 79 years old.
Part two of the interview.
Question to you, gentlemen. You have spent part of your lives working for the United States Justice Department, as we mentioned. You were part of the team that bagged John Gotti, so I'm sure that has been the subject of a lot of discussions with people who are fascinated by what you've done in your career. What is it about the Justice Department and the justice system, the criminal justice system, as you've been part of it? What about it? Tell me something about it that the public should know but doesn't know.
Well, I think one thing the public may not know, some people in the public may not know, when a federal prosecutor brings a criminal allegation, that decision has been vetted at multiple levels. And depending on the nature of the case, for instance, the Gotti case, that has been gone over, vetted, discussed, approved, all the way from Brooklyn to Washington, D.C. and back again at multiple levels. And there is a thoroughness in that vetting process that is very different than how crimes are prosecuted in the state. Most crimes are prosecuted in this country by state, county, local prosecutors. And they're operating on a much shorter timeline, and they've got to respond quickly to events happening in real time. And while there's some supervision there, they don't have time to really analyze a case the way that the feds often can. And that is a very important distinction, and it's part of the explanation why the federal conviction rate is so high. Because they usually don't bring a case unless they are very, very confident that they can get a conviction. Now, you know, I spent a lot of my time trying to change those statistics a little bit by getting my clients acquitted. But the fact of the matter is that that's an unusual and in some ways unique aspect of federal prosecution.
Matt, anything to add to that?
Yeah, you know, I've worked in as both a DA and I agree exactly with what Pat said. I guess my take on that is, and the thoroughness, I think that the feds take too much time. I think in these white-collar cases, they drag these poor guys forever. You know, once a subpoena's out and the press gets it, you're presumed by in the court of public opinion to have done something wrong. I think they need to get to it quicker. In fact, we used to sit through these indictment review meetings, and I was one of those guys. Maybe it's because of my background. I'm like, let's indict it. Let's go. Let's do something. But I think the federal system, they take too much time. They wait till the statute's going to run.
What about the politics of it? As it makes its way up through career prosecutors who work for Republicans and Democrats, may have been appointed by a Republican or Democrat, at some point it reaches a level where someone's got maybe a little more political acumen, perhaps axe to grind.
Well, I think there's no question that it's happened, and I would suggest that the problem is not that it's reaching someone in the formal line of approval who has a political agenda. I'm sure that has happened, but I think that's pretty rare. What I think is more dangerous and probably more common is you've got this long, and it takes a long time. You've got this long multi-stage approval process, and at any point, other people outside the chain of command can go in if they get wind of it, and people get wind of investigations. I mean, Mr. Gotti wasn't surprised we were investigating him. And people who have an interest in trying to lobby for or against a prosecution will put their oar in. They'll pick up the phone. They'll call people. I think that's the bigger danger. That's what I think most federal prosecutors involved in these bigger cases worry more about. They're not worried about the professionals being political, but they are worried that the longer it takes, the higher up it has to go to be approved, the more chance there is for somebody with a real political agenda or some clout, as we say around here, to get involved and try to head that indictment off.
The controversy about the firing of U.S. attorneys, in that storytelling that the American people were aware of, there were allegations made that I believe Senator Domenici was trying to sort of take a prosecution.
Right, and that's a great
move it towards the
right, and that's a great example of a politician trying to stick their nose in it. I worked on the Clark Clifford indictment 15 or almost 20 years ago, and I agree exactly what you said. The line prosecutors that had worked this case for years, their biggest fear was they're going to leave town one day and this is going to be changed either in the charging or the timing or whatever. And that's exactly what happened. I'm not saying it was bad about it. But the other point, I rarely saw political influence have that much to do with the prosecutorial decision.
I agree. It was,
even in
it
Cook
was
County,
rare.
Which
– It was rare, but I've seen it.
On that note, we want to say farewell to our guests. They are Patrick Brady. He is the chairman of the Republican Party of Illinois. And the next time back, we're going to talk about more hardcore politics, which we've been talking about a broader issues this evening. And your legal partner also has joined us this evening. He is Patrick Cotter. You're both with the same firm now, which is Barnes and Thornburg. And you've switched from being the prosecutor to the defense role now. So
outrageous government conduct.
So I can't say you're representing the bad guys, the alleged bad guys.
Certainly
not. The innocent.
No, we're still trying to clear things up for the government. We're just trying to help.
Thanks to Patrick Johnson and Ben Stewart for the production of this program. I'm Bruce Dumont. See you next week. So long, everybody.
100 years of engineering excellence is right on time. It's GMC Truck Month. Get into the Sierra 1500 SLT with an available 403 horsepower 6.2 liter V8. It's the most powerful half-ton V8 in its class. Plus, it comes with the safety and security of OnStar, standard for 1 year. And now get great financing offers, like 0% APR for 60 months for qualified buyers on all 09 Sierras, or $6,000 total cash back on 09 Sierra 1500 extended and crew cab vehicles that have been in stock the longest. Step up to the best. It's GMC Truck Month. See your GMC dealer today. Based on 2009 GM large pickup segment, excludes other GM vehicles. Visit OnStar.com for details and system limitations. Cashback only on 20% of vehicles available to dealer as of 9/21/09. Monthly payment is $16.67 for every $1,000 you finance. Example down payment 8.3%. Some customers will not qualify. Not available with some other offers. Take delivery by 11/2/09. See dealer for details.
Introducing Ally Bank's 9-month no-penalty CD with a great interest rate of 1.6% APY. Just to make that perfectly clear, that's a no-penalty CD. No penalty for early withdrawal, medium or late withdrawal, no extra fees, no minimum balance, and no fine print anywhere. Just a high-interest 9-month no-penalty CD that lets you move all your money anytime, anywhere. It doesn't get more straightforward than that. Call Ally at 877-247-ALLY or go to allybank.com. Ally, straightforward. Member FDIC.
Hello and welcome back to the show. Okay, with us today is that stack of money with the giant googly eyes. The money you could be saving with Geico. Tell me, it's really easy to get you. You just go to geico.com, right? Let's try two blinks for yes and one for no. Wait, did you just blink twice or once? Because I blinked and I missed it. Ugh, I keep blinking.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance. To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com.
Men, are you urinating more frequently? Do you wake up to urinate? Don't ignore your prostate health. See your doctor for checkups and call for a free bottle of Beta Prostate. Beta Prostate is a natural supplement that helps your body support prostate health. Your prostate affects the quality of your life, including your sleeping habits and intimacy. Beta Prostate has plant sterols shown to support healthy urine flow and healthy sleeping habits. And Beta Prostate is so powerful, you'd have to take 100 saw palmetto capsules to get the same plant sterols found in one Beta Prostate. New customers can get a free bottle of Beta Prostate. You only pay shipping and handling. To get your free bottle of Beta Prostate, call 1-800-922-4074. That's 1-800-922-4074. This offer is for one free bottle per household. Call now and try Beta Prostate for free. Call 1-800-922-4074. That's 1-800-922-4074.